You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on October 7th, 2013 from our studio in Newton, Massachusetts. Ahead this hour, Luke Vargas of the Talk Radio News Service joins me by phone from the United Nations to report on the recent General Assembly. Then I give the history of healthcare in the United States and an explanation of the Affordable Care Act. All this is just ahead on Arsenal for Democracy. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Sunday afternoon and is available for download on Monday nights or Tuesday mornings at billhumphreyresearch.com/radio and from iTunes and other locations. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Email us at afdradio@gmail.com or call and leave a message with your views and questions at 347-688-6676. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. Welcome to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me this week by phone from New York is Luke Vargas, United Nations correspondent for the Talk Radio News Service. Luke, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
So let's start with just the basics for our listeners who might not be that familiar with the operations of the United Nations. Luke, would you start off by explaining kind of the routine angle of why the UN's been in the news for the past few weeks, even without the serious stuff going on?
Well, the main reason is because of the meeting of the General Assembly. I guess the number of leaders that have actually showed up at the UN this year was close to the record high, 193 member states. I believe over 180 world leaders showed up to give remarks during the general debate session of the General Assembly. So in terms of rhetoric, the UN is playing a pretty big role in the eyes of leaders from around the world, and that's why they're addressing a number of the biggest issues in the world in their speeches.
As you mentioned, this was a good year for world leaders to show up in person, but of course in the past there have been lots of famous or infamous speeches from world leaders at the at these General Assembly meetings. And the last decade, of course, was dominated by those fire-breathing addresses by the late President Hugo Chavez of Venezuela or Iran's former President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. So what was the significance of President Hassan Rouhani's speech from Iran at the General Assembly this year?
Well, I was amazed just from the angle of a reporter who works on the premises day in and day out. The number of email invitations I was receiving from the Iranian delegation, they were thrusting their newly elected president into the spotlight, trying to get him as much face time with members of the press, with other leaders who were in town for the General Assembly. It was quite overwhelming, actually, the extent to which it seemed like they were trying to put him in the public spotlight. And I have to say, we just heard, yesterday, some remarks by Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, talking about his impressions of Rouhani's sort of PR blitz in New York. He said he was supportive of the diplomatic initiative that his speech, created at the UN, and then said essentially that there were some elements of his time in New York that weren't appropriate. But I have to say, in retrospect, I think Iran was very effective in what they did in New York, essentially putting Israel, at least in my opinion, on its heels a bit, making Israel feel very isolated as world leaders and the media flocked to Iran's leaders. In years past, there's been, as you mentioned, a tremendous amount of skepticism about Iran at the UN. Their speeches, stirring up controversy, being filled with hatred towards other groups, particularly Israel. And here, the willingness of everyone to run and speak to Iran, I think, really spooked Benjamin Netanyahu, and you heard that in his speech. And then even more broadly, I think there is a lot of success of the Iranian position in having so much of the Western press label a longstanding member of Iran's defense establishment, Rouhani, a moderate. I just keep reading in so many news articles that he's a political moderate. And it's not really what I'm seeing and what a number of other sources that I'm hearing from are saying. They're concerned about the fact that Iran perhaps has succeeded in getting the ear of the United States after, you know, basically being turned away for so many years, and that things maybe are slipping the wrong direction as far as Iranian relations are concerned.
So it seems like the Iranian full court press is working. Their diplomatic goals are succeeding. Do you think that Rouhani gives the United Nations as a whole a way back in on the ongoing nuclear issue with Iran, maybe opening a door that Ahmadinejad had kept closed?
Ahmadinejad definitely kept a door closed, but I don't know what doors Rouhani has actually opened. The UN really isn't talking too much about getting involved in the Iranian nuclear control. We're quite a ways away from having OPCW type negotiators or inspectors rather showing up in Tehran to begin looking at what Iran has. They're still very secretive about that nuclear program. I've just heard some remarks from John Kerry in Bali, basically appearing to turn down an Iranian proposal about nuclear negotiations. They were essentially saying, United States, what concessions are you willing to make now if we begin nuclear talks, suggesting maybe the U.S. should scale back its plans for missile defense systems in Europe? This is a demand that Russia's had for quite a long time. So I think the U.S. has long said that they're waiting to see actions from Iran instead of just rhetoric. I think that's definitely true. Once, I guess next week, we're going to have negotiations between nuclear officials from both countries. I think once the proposals start coming to the table, really working with Iran is going to seem less and less appealing. It was certainly fun to go to all the press conferences in New York and to show an apparent thaw in relations, but I think when push comes to shove, I don't think their political positions on the nuclear issue have changed too much. I guess it remains to be seen, but if Kerry's remarks are any indication, the U.S. is going to be inevitably unhappy with the things they're asked to do when it comes to reaching agreement on the nuclear issue with Iran.
Now, you were just mentioning a moment ago about that there's not inspectors on the ground in Iran, but if we look at Syria now, we've actually seen reports that, unlike with the Iran situation, we're seeing some movement there. There are UN technicians and other folks on the ground now in Syria over the weekend, beginning that process of dismantling the chemical weapons stockpile. And that's a huge improvement over where we were a little over a month ago. Is there a sense at the UN that the UN is back in a meaningful role on the Syria question?
Oh, there's no doubt about it that getting regulators on the ground there, overseeing the destruction of chemical weapons. Just to recap, on Sunday, yesterday, there was the first destruction of certain facilities that was using essentially welding torches to render warheads and other equipment unusable. John Kerry was upbeat about this, saying that it's only been a week since the Security Council resolution that opened the pathway for these OPCW officials to go to the country, and that now we're already seeing the benefits of their work. But it is a very long process. I don't want to really paint myself as a skeptic or an optimist on whether or not destroying these chemical weapons changes the Syrian conflict too much and improves the situation for anyone who's involved. But it is going to be at least until the middle of next year until apparently the entire stockpile of chemical weapons in Syria can be destroyed. And the most vocal position I'm hearing about this destruction of chemical weapons are from activists on the ground who are saying the Assad spent a tremendous amount of energy, dedicated hundreds if not thousands of his best fighters to be stationed around the country guarding these chemical weapons for the past few years, and that now that the OPCW is going to those sites, that they're essentially being secured by outside inspectors, that he might be able to reposition those assets and perhaps use them against other parts of the country to steer his firepower against the opposition in new places that he hasn't been able to for the past year. So I guess there's some encouragement at the UN about what these OPCW inspectors and, you know, people who are overseeing the destruction of the weapons might be able to do. But there is also a tremendous amount of concern about, you know, where Assad might be able to dedicate his resources now that there are outsiders guarding his weapons, essentially.
Now, the other huge angle of the Syria situation that hasn't been getting as much press attention, of course, is the refugee crisis that's been ongoing. Could you give us a little bit of insight onto if we're seeing any developments on that front?
One of the things I was watching for, just to recap some of the numbers for your listeners, there are estimated to be about 3 million refugees from the Syrian crisis who have fled the country. About the same number are internally displaced within Syria. Next year, I guess there was a UN official who said in Geneva today that they expect about 2 million will be added to that toll by the end of 2014. I'm going to be going to Jordan in 2 weeks to look in to the refugee crisis. And one of the major questions I'm going to be asking people is whether or not the Syria that looks to be ahead, what might come out of any sort of negotiated settlement that's possible in the next year or so, is a country they would really want to return to. Never mind the physical damage and, I guess, the scars of this conflict, but what about the lifestyle that people are going to be returning to in a post-Assad Syria? What freedoms are they going to have? And I think the reality is that any sort of negotiated settlement that is possible in the next year is not going to be able to offer really any assuring answers to those questions. It really remains to be seen what kind of country Syria could be if, for example, Geneva II talks are possible in the next few months. There is a big power struggle, as I'm sure you're aware, among the opposition in Syria, not to take up too much time in answering about the refugees, but a major development in the country over the past week was this document called the Communique Number 1, which was signed at first by about a dozen opposition groups who essentially said, we're unwilling to use the Syrian National Coalition, which is a sort of a Western-facing opposition front that is based in Turkey and been holed up in hotels, and they regularly come to the United Nations, including a visit in which I was able to speak to some of them a few months ago, and they talked to John Kerry. These rebel groups signed this document saying, we're impatient. We're not going to wait around for these Western-facing opposition groups to negotiate on our behalf. They're looking at the U.S. position. The U.S. really wants to get to the negotiating table, and apparently so does Russia and Assad to some extent. They don't want the U.S. to be able to choose negotiations instead of victory in Syria. And they're saying, we want to unite. We want to create an Islamic state in Syria. We are supportive of Sharia law. Again, a lot of concern among those fighting in the country that negotiation is being, you know, essentially held up instead of victory on the ground. And again, this all has implications for the refugees who have to decide when it's an appropriate time to return to this country. And if Islamist forces inevitably control most of the non-Assad parts of the country, it may not be a country they really ever want to return to. And that has big implications for all the countries housing refugees at this point.
So last question, do you see any real prospects for wider UN involvement in Syria beyond this chemical weapons dismantling that we've seen? Is there going to be any Security Council action, anything to do with the refugees, any sort of activity at all?
Well, the UN is apparently working on a new refugee appeal. They've been, I would say, relatively unsuccessful in getting all the money for past appeals on the refugee issue, which is very disconcerting to people here in the building. There was a statement issued last week on the heels of that, monumental Security Council resolution on chemical weapons, but it was only a presidential statement on humanitarian aid. Essentially, the Security Council, in a non-binding way, urging the Assad government to allow the creation of humanitarian hubs within Syria. But just to remind your listeners, I think the hope was a few months ago, at least on the humanitarian front at the United Nations, that if the U.S. and other European countries could somehow find groups within Syria to supply with weapons, that humanitarian aid could sort of piggyback on those connections. But inevitably, as you know, the U.S. was not able to decide on which groups in Syria were really deserving and moderate enough to receive that aid. And I think that has big and negative implications for the humanitarian crisis in the country. And as it stands now, I think it's going to be very hard to move past this Security Council statement on humanitarian aid and get a resolution. So we're left, again, as we have been for the past 2.5 years, with very brave humanitarian groups trying to get into that country and deliver aid. But beyond that, I think the UN, unfortunately, is on the outside looking in, and the best it can do is to help out countries like Jordan and Turkey and Lebanon, as well as Egypt and others, including Iraq, with their respective humanitarian problems. But there is no way for the UN to really get into Syria and start directing things in a coordinated fashion.
Well, Luke, thanks so much for taking the time to bring us these insights.
Sure. It's been a pleasure speaking to you.
My guest has been Luke Vargas, a United Nations correspondent for the Talk Radio News Service. After a break, Arsenal for Democracy will return for the history of healthcare in the United States and an explanation of the Affordable Care Act. All this is just ahead, right here on Arsenal for Democracy from WVUD and BillHumphreyResearch.com/radio. Stay tuned. The big news in the past week has been the shutdown of the United States federal government. Essentially, the Constitution authorizes Congress to appropriate money to pay for government functions. If the government doesn't have money, it has to shut down. Ideally, under laws passed in the second half of the 20th century, the President of the United States is supposed to propose a budget each year, identifying spending priorities and suggested areas to make cuts, and Congress is supposed to pass a budget annually, usually based loosely off the presidential proposal, but not necessarily. But in the absence of a majority in both chambers supporting a budget plan, they can instead pass a continuing resolution, which keeps the funding for the government's operations going at existing levels without adjusting for inflation or making any policy changes up or down on specific programs. In the absence of a budget or a continuing resolution, anything that doesn't have self-contained funding mechanisms or permanent appropriations like the military or Social Security insurance checks has to be shut down until a new budget or CR is approved. All federal employees, programs, agencies, research, grants, etc. must have new appropriations approved or else they're sent home and turned off. The millions of employees aren't fired, but rather they're put on what's called a furlough, which is an indefinite unpaid vacation. Many of these employees were already on partial furlough due to 10% across-the-board spending cuts put into place earlier this year by the so-called sequester that was passed in 2011. Now, the president last got a budget passed in 2010 between the election, which the Republicans won, and the new Republican majority taking office. Republicans then forced a number of rounds of major funding cuts in 2011, 2012, and 2013, every time that continuing resolutions were about to expire or the debt ceiling was about to be hit. The Senate Democrats spent the past month offering all kinds of compromises and cuts to House Republicans to persuade them to pass a new CR. Nothing worked, so the continuing resolution expired and the government shut down. The Republicans were planning to do this all year, by most accounts, and there's some documentation supporting that from various conferences and meetings that they had had. But they hadn't really decided what the reason for the shutdown was going to be. Again, this is searching for a problem to go with an answer that they've already come up with. Now, eventually, Senator Ted Cruz of Texas somehow got House Republicans to say that they would only fund the government if the Senate Dems agreed to open up the Affordable Care Act to renegotiation. But the Senate majority is very unlikely to do that, since, you know, for no other reason than because most of the Democrats who voted in favor of the act just a few years ago are still in the Senate. But also, as we discussed on the last episode of Arsenal for Democracy, it's the signature Democratic law of the past decade. And the House has already voted 42 times to repeal the law while the Senate ignored it. And that's a pretty good sign that the Senate hasn't changed its views on this and isn't willing to open this back up to negotiation, even if the president were willing to. So the government is still shut down until House Speaker John Boehner finds a majority, probably carved out of both parties, that's willing to vote for something that the Senate would actually vote through. Until that happens, everything has to remain off because there's no money to pay for it. But let's back up a little bit and figure out how we got into this position, not on the budget side, but in terms of the healthcare side, that they decided they were going to shut down the government because this purported tyranny of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, commonly known as Obamacare, unofficially, that was so unacceptable that they had to shut down the entire government. So let's go back and look at the background, going back pretty far, of how we got to where we are today. Now, of course, health insurance as a government-related concept and something that the government has a role in goes back to the 1880s in Imperial Germany with Otto von Bismarck, the arch-conservative chancellor who basically decided that the best way to combat the Socialist Party's political growth in his country and prevent radicalism was to address some of the concerns of workers by giving them a social insurance system that would help kind of offset the their expenses and keep them out of poverty. But the United States was a lot more reticent to go along with some of these ideas. So the first big step in the direction of some sort of government role in health and that sort of thing, the first big step is in 1935 when, as part of the New Deal, FDR gets to sign this plan, what we now call Social Security, and it had a much longer name. But basically, this was part of his system for combating the Great Depression, but also for providing a longer-term solution well beyond the Great Depression. Now, the Social Security system as it exists in the United States is basically a mandatory social insurance system that has the primary goal is to prevent poverty among retirees, widows, and disabled workers. Again, a lot of this is the basic concept from the 1880s German system, although that was specifically focused on health, but there were some retirement insurance aspects as well to that for workers, especially those who had become disabled early. And Social Security was the same thing. We mostly hear about it in the context of retirees, but the original plan was also for protection of so-called survivors, which was generally statistically going to be women whose husbands had predeceased them, but not necessarily women. And it's also for disabled workers in addition to these retirees. And so the concept here is that it's financed by worker contribution and employer contribution. Recipients get money from the next generation of payees having earned it, earned their payout by contributing for an earlier generation, and which is where we get the concept that they are entitled to receive the benefits, because if you pay in, you're entitled to get it out. So that's why we call it an entitlement. And the outcome of Social Security was a pretty solid success, that there was no longer a problem of mass elder poverty, which had been a really serious issue even outside of the context of the Great Depression. Social Security, of course, is the first huge entitlement program in the United States. And of course, the critics at the time still thought that this was some sort of communist plot or whatever. But interestingly, the first universal health care plans didn't even come in until in the Soviet Union, where that started, until 1937. So this is a pretty limited and straightforward, logical plan that prevents mass elder poverty. Nonetheless, very strong opposition from a lot of conservatives. So we fast forward to after World War II, and we get to 1947. Harry Truman looks at this wave of universal health care and universal health insurance systems being put into place across Western Europe following the Beveridge reports and a lot of the post-war reconstruction going on there. And the idea in Europe was that they needed to have some sort of safety net when basically everything had been destroyed in these countries. They needed to have a safety net that prevented a mass poverty problem from happening and ensured that people had a way to get treatment for basic health needs in the aftermath of World War II. But it also, again, was kind of along the lines of Bismarck's original conservative plans in the 1880s. The idea was to prevent the appeal of radicalism and extreme socialism and communism, especially when the Soviet Union was trying to make various outreach efforts into Western Europe through communist parties there. So the idea was that if they put those into place, that would help meet basic needs of the society during a very tense and difficult period following the wars, and it would make those governments, more moderate governments, and anti-communist governments more stable and secure on the home front. So Harry Truman, the president of the United States and the successor to FDR, looks at this in 1947 and says, hey, I think we should have something like that. And the anti-communists in both the Democratic and Republican parties at the time immediately rally with private industry against the plan, saying that it's socialist and it's un-American, so on and so forth. So instead of going down this path of universal health care, the United States moves toward a system centered around private health insurance and funded by generous corporate contribution and small employee contributions. So the idea here is that a large corporate employee pool helps lower costs by putting a lot of premiums and corporate contributions into the funding pool. So it's not like having a single payer system where there's one huge body that negotiates all medical prices and keeps the cost down. But still, if you have 1,000 or 10,000 workers in your huge corporation and they're all getting health insurance from one company, they can bargain to lower costs that way because there's more of them. And the idea from the private companies' perspectives, in addition to the fact that it was the post-war period and they were generally flush with cash and high on profits because there wasn't competition from the rest of the industrialized world since it was destroyed during the war, they were able to offer this, but it also was an advantage to these companies to offer it. The premise being that you would want your workers to be healthy so that they can continue working and that they're happy and they don't have to take time off of work or have to quit their job, so on and so forth, that their families are cared for. So again, they don't have a reason to need to leave work. So it helps stabilize the workforce. But of course, this system only really works if you have a society that has full employment so that people can get their health coverage through an employer, a system that doesn't have a lot of career switching like we see today, where people would basically get a job and it would be their permanent job from the time they graduated high school to the time that they retired, that would be the end-all be-all of their career experience. So as long as they were with that corporation, if it was like Ford or General Motors or some steel company or something, or a rubber tire manufacturer, you'd be with that company for the entire time, and then you would have your health taken care of by that company. As I said, they could afford to do this on the corporate side because it was an era of high corporate profits. And people, again, they weren't switching jobs. They also weren't even moving across state lines. So it was a system that worked with even having the states regulating insurance separately because no one was trying to go across state lines or move around. So it wasn't an issue like we see today where people are afraid to leave their jobs or move to some other place where there are jobs, better jobs available because they're afraid of losing their health insurance. That just wasn't a factor for most people at the time. So once that system starts breaking down by the late 1960s and employers can't afford to offer the insurance or people want to switch careers and jobs, then that's where we start having a problem. And then that, of course, you know, eventually leads us to the position that we've been in more recently. Now, in 1965, Lyndon Johnson passed Medicare, which was an amendment to the Social Security Act. And the idea was that all Social Security recipients, who, of course, are retired and in many cases would not have health insurance anymore, we've solved the poverty side of being elderly. But now we want these recipients to also be healthy so that they can live longer in their retirement. And their main care is paid for by Medicare under the system passed in 1965. And Medicare is essentially a small-scale version of some of these single-payer systems that you see in other countries. Basically, and it's similar to the Canadian system rather than the British system. So the Canadian system doesn't own the hospitals or facilities, doesn't pay the doctors directly, unlike the British system. The idea is that Medicare compensates doctors for their services to these elderly folks who are on Social Security. And that way, you make sure that the people that are in retirement age have a way to get their health care paid for so they don't have to pay for it themselves, or at least don't have to pay for all of it themselves. Now, over time, various options have been added since the original 1965 version, so you can do a little bit of customization and tailoring and have some user choice. Lyndon Johnson also, as part of his Great Society packages, passes something called Medicaid, which provides federal money co-funded by the state governments to provide minimum health care to citizens under the poverty line. And that is less of an insurance type system, like a single block insurance like Medicare, and it's more of going toward the care side, although still generally is paying for the care, compensating the doctors, and again, doesn't involve owning the hospitals or anything like that, in most cases anyway. So after these Medicaid and Medicare reforms come in 1965, on top of the private insurance system that had emerged after the World War II as the norm, theoretically at least, every poor person, everyone with a job, and every old person has their health care paid for. Now, of course, there's plenty of exceptions to that, and not all jobs actually did provide health insurance. But theoretically, we've now got a large percentage of the population that's covered, and there's only smaller gaps in between that would need to be filled in. And that kind of becomes the genesis in the post-1960s period of trying to find a way to finish covering everyone. Because we'd clearly gone down the path of going for a health insurance-oriented system rather than a health care system like the British have, where the government is directly providing and paying for the care through hospitals that they own and that sort of thing, as opposed to just coming up with a system that helps finance it. Now, in 1971, Republican President Richard Nixon proposes mandating that every employer offer health insurance, as well as he wanted to turn Medicaid into a state-run health insurance system, not just a compensation system for low-income people, but he wanted it to be a state-run system that was open to everyone, offering various plans at different levels according to income and needs. So there would be, this is sort of the public option, kind of a very early version of that proposal, which is where the government would be offering something, not just a flat unified system like Medicare, but actually offering different plans administered by the state governments and partly funded by the federal government. Now, the Democratic Congress shot that down because they wanted a much more comprehensive public system, probably toward universal health care, a system that would cut out the private employers entirely because, as we've talked about, there are some flaws that had started to emerge at that point. Of having the private private corporations providing the insurance. Even if the insurance is private, it becomes a problem if the employers are providing it, because then it ties people to the jobs and it forces those companies to spend a lot of money providing the putting up the money and buying into these systems, not just the premiums that the employees have to pay. But this is the first time that we see a mandate proposed seriously, and also it's the first proposal outside of the monolithic Medicare to offer publicly run health insurance plans, but it doesn't really go anywhere, as I said. Now, in 1986, the United States mandated that anyone coming into an emergency room has to be treated, regardless of insurance status or ability to pay. If someone comes in and they don't have insurance and they can't afford to pay for the treatment, the hospital has to treat them anyway and cannot just send them off to another hospital, which had been a problem since before then. This means that as of 1986, no one can be denied care, basic care, but it's not really the ideal system because it creates a problem where millions of people who make too much money, they earn too much money to get Medicaid, but don't earn enough money to buy private insurance on their own and don't get it through their job, they are then forced to get treatment through emergency rooms. And that could be pretty basic stuff, but then if you go in with, preventative things, they don't really treat you there. So in effect, you end up having to wait around until your problem has gotten past the early detection stages, when of course it's much less expensive and much more effective to get things. You got to wait until you are collapsing on the street, basically, before you can go in and get treated. And that is not at all the ideal system that you want to have. It also puts a lot of strain on the hospitals and the private insurance system because they end up having to pick up the tab anyway. You hear various conservatives saying, that they don't want to pay for other people's health insurance and stuff like that, but you do that anyway already under the current system. It's just a hidden cost. Your premiums go up because, and the hospital costs go up because the hospitals have to then absorb the costs of the people who are uninsured through no fault of their own and have to come get this super expensive tens of thousands of dollars in emergency room care that could have been dealt with much more simply at a lower cost if someone had insurance that got them into preventative treatments early on. we don't want to continue having a system where 40 million people get their health care by walking into an emergency room when something super bad happens. That doesn't, it concentrates the burden too much, and it puts the burden anyway on the people who already have health insurance. So we should try to figure out a way that works better than this. This is our sort of version of a universal healthcare system, was just to mandate that they had to cover it, but without any sort of payment mechanism, that they had to provide this care. That is not a workable system, and we need to fix it so it's more, so it's better funded and more efficient. Now, of course, there were some attempts in 1993 under First Lady Hillary Clinton and President Bill Clinton to come up with some systems that would replace the private insurance system with a different privatized system oriented around HMOs. That didn't really go anywhere. There was a lot of backlash from the industry. They got the Democrats to fall apart on that in Congress. It wasn't ever articulated very well, so it didn't really go anywhere. But it wasn't all that of a liberal proposal. Again, a lot of this, as I've said, is within this overall trend of going toward the private side and sticking with that private insurance system so that you don't have this so-called socialism of a universal healthcare system. Now, we kind of got the first demonstration of how the sort of ultimate end of the line of this privatized universal system comes in 2006 when Governor Mitt Romney signed an act providing access to affordable, quality, accountable health care from Massachusetts. So Democratic legislature in Massachusetts, Republican governor, and they passed this plan that was actually pushed very hard by conservative think tanks in Washington, many of the same ones that now oppose the Affordable Care Act, even though it's based all off the same concepts. And they were pushing it, again, as an alternative to going down that socialized medicine route that I think a lot of New Englanders and Massachusetts people would probably like to see. And it, of course, is very good for the private insurance companies to continue having a system that encourages more and more people to get on private insurance, because they are in it as a business to make a profit. So this is something that helps them. And, you know, big business, conservatives, they're all tight, and they always have been in the post-war period. That hasn't really changed. This helps those private insurance companies. So, of course, those firms were on board with this plan as well. Now, key components of the Massachusetts plan included a individual mandate. And this is different from the corporate mandate that we heard from Nixon's proposal. This is saying that in addition to corporations having to provide health insurance for all their full-time workers, that the individuals also have to be are required to have some form of insurance. So if they don't get it through their employer, they have to find another way of getting to it. And if they don't, they would face a tax penalty. So to help ease the burden that the state is now imposing on employers and individuals by making them cover the more employees and by making individuals buy into this, the state expanded Medicaid eligibility on its own, regardless of the federal government, so that more low-income people who couldn't afford to buy their own insurance were then covered under the government-funded plans. And then they also, that, you know, once you've mandated more of the full-time employees to get coverage, now you've again widened the pool on the other side. So it just leaves a relatively small number of people who are uninsured and have to buy insurance on their own to avoid the penalties. And the penalties were comparable to the amount you'd end up having to pay into to get private insurance. So a lot of people opted to do that. Now, the downside, as we've mentioned before on Arsenal for Democracy, was that Mitt Romney cut out some of the tax measures and cost controls that were using a line item veto, and those were intended to prevent the state from having to go into debt on the proposal or having to bear a lot of the costs kind of out of nowhere without a funding mechanism for it. And that did come to pass, that they ended up having some cost overruns that could have been avoided. But that was Mitt Romney's fault, not the fault of the original plan passed by the Democratic legislature. The state did end up having to spend quite a bit of money, but the upside was that 99.97% approximately of residents in Massachusetts now have health insurance, and that means they can afford to see a doctor for preventative care instead of going to the ER, and that is all around good for all the reasons that I've mentioned previously. Now, in 2009 and 2010, there was much debate and finally passage of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. After extensive debate, they included a lot of Republican proposals and conservative Democratic proposals, but they still got no Republican votes. As I said before, it's based pretty closely on the conservative Romney care model for Massachusetts, which is sort of ironic that they would then turn on this and say that it's unacceptable, even though, of course, it's a huge package designed to boost up the private health insurance industry and continue to give them more customers. So, what is the basic goal of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act? Right after the break, I'll explain all that and more right here on Arsenal for Democracy from WVUD and BillHumphreyResearch.com/radio. Back in a moment. I'm Bill Humphrey, and you're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm talking this hour about healthcare in the United States and how we got to where we stand today. All the history I've just been covering leads us up to 2010 and the passage of a new health insurance reform package. So, what was the goal of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act? At its core, the goal is to pay through various means for 40 million more people to have access to healthcare, and hopefully to do a little bit of work expanding the care itself as well. And of course, you hear there's the two parts in the title, the patient protections and the affordable care part. Now, on the protection side, we get pre-existing conditions covered. Those can be costly to insurers. So if people had a pre-existing condition when they went to apply for insurance for the first time, previously the insurance companies could say, no, you can't do that. We're going to turn you away because we don't want to make these huge payouts that are going to far exceed the premiums that you're paying in over a long period of time. And they would just deny people coverage. So can't do that anymore. And 2 million young adults will get to stay on their parental insurance until they turn 26. That also helps by targeting a large section of the 40 million unemployed, or at least a significant section, who were people who would want health insurance and weren't staying off of it by choice, but their employers, especially at the entry-level positions, were not offering health insurance. And this is, you know, going to help them, because if their parents are employed through positions that have health insurance, then they can stay on that until they get a job that offers their own health insurance plan. And then, of course, you know, as I'll get to in a moment, a lot more of these young people also start getting health insurance, because now if you work 40 or more hours a week, you're considered a full-time employee, and the government has to, I think it might even be closer to 30 hours a week. The government is saying that you as a corporation have to pay your employees, provide your employees with health insurance coverage that previously had been optional. The other protection that we get is preventative treatment is encouraged. Again, that avoids costly emergency care. I mean, you've all heard of people who had cancer or something that wasn't detected until later, that made it much harder to treat. But you've also heard of someone who got it detected very early and they got it taken care of right away and they went into remission and they were fine and did not pass away from having that cancer. And that goes well beyond cancer to many, many areas of things, where if you can get in on some early checkup that finds out something by coincidence, or you think you might have an issue and you go in and get it taken care of before it becomes a huge problem, that saves everyone money all across the board. And it keeps emergency care focused on actual emergencies and things that couldn't have been avoided, like accidents. And the insurance companies, there was another protection that most people haven't heard about, but the insurance companies had a cap set by the government on their advertising and overhead budgets, how much they could spend advertising their insurance and how much they could spend on administrative costs and paying their executives and things like that. And it was capped as a percentage, I believe, of the consumer premiums. So if they spend more than that percentage, they have to refund the difference to the customer. And that is basically a way of encouraging the companies to be very careful about how their insurance rates go up and justifying those rate increases and making sure that their goal is not just to make a profit, but also to be genuinely providing care and not just trying to milk customers for as much money as possible. And that's going to be one of the really key protections that I think is going to help with this. And, you know, this is one of the important things that had to be put into place on the insurance companies in exchange for giving them all these new customers, as is the result of the individual and corporate mandates. So, of course, the corporate mandate, as I said, full-time employees or near full-time employees now have to be provided with health insurance. And the government also offers some forms of help to small businesses to be in compliance with this as well. The individual mandate, as we've talked about before, based off the Massachusetts system, includes light penalties for non-compliance, and it also, the government offers subsidies to buy these low-end so-called bronze plans that we talked about pretty extensively on the last episode of Arsenal for Democracy, and that is to help people who are, again, above that Medicaid eligibility line, but do not have insurance through their employers and cannot afford to buy it on their own. And it's not, it doesn't cover everyone, but it helps get some people, hopefully across that line. And then there, you know, as I said, there's some penalties, but they're not as substantial as the Massachusetts ones, to say the least. Also, the government, further closed that gap of uninsured people by expanding the Medicaid eligibility. So the Medicaid coverage goes up from the federal poverty line up to, I believe, 138% starting in January 2014. And so that means that if you make, you know, below the poverty line or up to the federal poverty line, that means that you are currently eligible to get to enroll in Medicaid. And they're going to expand that to help, again, with those people who can't quite, they're making too much money to get Medicaid currently, but they also don't have enough money to invest in private health insurance themselves on an individual basis. And the original plan was that the federal government would pay for all of it in the first few years and then get small contributions from the states in later years. Failure to participate would lose those states their existing Medicaid grant money from the federal government. The Supreme Court ruled in 2012 that this was unconstitutional. You couldn't force that on the states. So the states are allowed to opt in now to the expansion, but they aren't required to. So exactly half of the states have opted in, just under half have opted out. And it's still under debate in a few states because the state of Arkansas asked the president and got approval from the White House and the Obama administration to be able to make some tinkering and customization with their version of the plan, the expansion plan, and, you know, things like work requirements and such. And with those modifications and the ability to make some of those modifications, some Republican governors who had previously been planning to turn it down are now taking a second look and might opt in with some modified version. Another element of the Affordable Care Act was that the insurance industry was compelled to cover more expensive people in exchange for more healthy people. This isn't a requirement so much as a conceptual thing about it. The, you know, we've talked about those protections. Those can be expensive for the private insurance companies, but because of the mandate, they're getting more customers. So that was the trade-off there. The insurance companies get a lot more customers, but in exchange for that, and that includes a lot of healthy young uninsured people who are going to be paying in, or the government's going to be paying it on their behalf, but they're not going to be getting sick that much, at least theoretically and statistically. So they're probably not going to be as expensive as some of these people who might have had these chronic pre-existing conditions that are going to be expensive to treat. So that helps offset some of that and hopefully comes out with a positive balance. And knowing the insurance industry, which is very profitable, I'm sure that they'll do just fine. The bigger the pool, the healthier the pool, the healthier... you know, a healthier pool is a less expensive pool for the insurers. They get to keep their costs from rising as fast. That was supposed to be one of the other theoretical gains here, was that the consumers would save money because the cost, the rate increases would go up more slowly as a whole bunch of uninsured but healthy people were brought into the system. We also talked on the last episode, of course, about the health insurance exchanges. They opened last week. And that is essentially a federal service that allows an uninsured person to compare easily between insurance plans from different private companies at different levels. I think there's catastrophic, which is the really basic thing that helps pay if you have a huge accident, but you're not paying for preventative care or anything like that. You've got your basic bronze level plan, silver level plan, gold level plan, platinum plan. These things go up in price, but they also go up in what they cover. And those are all offered by the, again, by private companies within each state. So that all the plans remain privately run. And the analogy that I came up with was that the government is basically operating a shopping mall in each state for you to go window shopping between businesses before buying an insurance plan, but it doesn't own any of the businesses in the mall. So, you know, this isn't some huge government-created thing that the conservatives are trying to convince everyone it is. This is more of a formality and service that helps people compare between these things. Now, each private insurance company, as we talked about on the last episode, offers a plan classified at one of those levels based on a rough range of premiums, copays, out-of-pocket deductible costs to you as the customer. And the lower the plan, the less you pay up front each month, but the more you pay of the total cost of treatment if you get sick or have an accident and need it later. So you get to figure out by looking at these exchanges which level you can afford, and then you compare between companies, say, for example, Blue Cross versus Aetna, and you compare within your state and say, you see, okay, you know, between the silver level plan from Blue Cross and the silver level plan from Aetna, which one costs me more money, which one gives me better perks, you know, or benefits, and you can see how good the coverage is and see what works for your budget. And of course, this has to be done through every state because insurance is regulated at a state level, as I alluded to earlier, and that prevents deregulation races to the bottom like we saw when credit cards were deregulated like that and allowed to be interstate operations. Basically, all the credit card companies went to states like Delaware or South Dakota, and that meant that sometimes they were allowed to engage in some of those abusive practices that had to be curbed a few years ago by federal legislation. Because if the state doesn't have a particular regulation on it and there's no state line limits on it, then the companies can set up in a state with lax regulation and then offer those things everywhere else. So the idea is that you keep insurance state-based to prevent regulatory abuses, and that way hopefully most people have reasonably regulated plans offered within their state. And the concept, of course, of the exchange is at its core very free market and right wing. It was a conservative proposal, and it still is very conservative. On top of the fact that it's a huge giveaway to the health insurance companies that are private corporations, the concept that had people come up with this idea in the first place was very conservative and free market. It's the idea that competition lowers costs, but market competition only exists when consumers can choose between comparable options with full information. So the consumer uses the exchange to get full information on these similar plans at the same level, and that forces insurers to reduce their costs, their overhead, their everything to outcompete each other, kind of like we see the airlines always competing with these various low budget options, and they'll be advertising those all the time. And before, it was sort of an opaque world where you couldn't really compare easily between plans if you were someone that had a choice between plans, whether through your employer or on your own as a private citizen, if you didn't get it through your employer. And so consumers now can take a look at that and choose between the two plans of two different companies and see which one works better for them and is going to get them better stuff, better value for their dollars that they put in. So again, the government isn't offering a plan or anything like that. The government is just showing you, look, here are some easily comparable plans at your level. Choose which one works best for you. Also on the care side, there was $8 million appropriated through an amendment by Bernie Sanders of Vermont, the only one of the few independents in Congress and the only sort of socialist identified senator. And he got this appropriation in for opening new healthcare clinics for low income and rural patients. Vermont obviously has a significant rural population, but there are lots of states in this country that do. And, you know, it's not a huge amount, but it does help if you can open more of these sort of low-cost basics clinics that, again, keeps people out of the emergency room by giving them the preventative treatment that they need. And it solves the problem of some people not having access to hospitals. So that's one of the small improvements toward actual health care rather than health coverage that was made by the Affordable Care Act. The government also, and this is the final component here, the government also pays for all these increased costs that we've talked about through a variety of tax mechanisms, including the so-called tanning tax, some weirdly unrelated fuel taxes and subsidy cuts on various fuel subsidies and things. And these changes became effective immediately to front-load the revenues before the government had to start spending. That cuts down on the need for deficit spending, and in theory, that means that the entire Affordable Care Act is a more than $900 billion new setup and legislation, but it's still budget neutral over 10 years, which is necessary. That became necessary for some wonky procedural reasons that I've talked about on the previous episodes of the show, to get the votes for passage after Scott Brown was elected. Basically, to go through the Senate with some final changes, they and not need to overcome a filibuster, just need to get 51 votes. The Democrats had to figure out a way to make sure that the entire plan was not going to increase the deficit and therefore could go through an omnibus bill. And you can only do that if it's deficit neutral. So it is a big operation, but with those small taxes on various things, you know, the idea being that you reduce health care costs by discouraging tanning that causes skin cancer, things like that. Then there were some of those unrelated ones, like in the fuel areas. And then there were some changes, some of which have been postponed temporarily, some changes to Medicare compensation structures to try to change how that is done and make that more cost effective for the government and cut out fraud and abuse and things like that. And that's supposed to all save enough money that the government ends up, at least in the first 10 years, not spending more than they are taking in. And that is, it brings us up again to where we get to the government shutdown, which to me, it seems ridiculous, of course, that there's going to be a government, that there's a government shutdown happening over a plan that is fundamentally conservative at heart, brings private corporations a lot of new business, and is not even a huge entitlement that explodes the deficit as they keep on trying to claim that it is going to be. So that is the background on the history of the U.S. health reform efforts, as well as the most recent efforts, and an update on the government shutdown. That's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy for October 7th, 2013. The show is recorded at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts weekly and is available for download from billhumphreyresearch.com/radio on Tuesdays. You can hear a repeat of it on 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark or at WVUD.org every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin, and my guest, Luke Vargas. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.